This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, it is good to have you listening in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. We have an unusual treat on today's program. I have the opportunity to teach a couple of classes at Herbert W. Armstrong College, sponsored by the organization behind Trumpet Radio. We have students here from all over the world, including one that regular listeners of this program have heard a number of times, Rufaro Manyepa. He's from Zimbabwe, as is another of our students, Kumberai Matebalombo. They are two very impressive young men, and it has made us curious about what sort of education they received back in their native country. So later on in the program, we're going to have a conversation with them about education and what sort of education they received and what has surprised them about education in America. They have a unique perspective that I think you'll find quite fascinating. A lot of Americans are concerned that the upcoming presidential election will be heatedly contested and could end in violence. Well, a new expose by Project Veritas shows that there are people deliberately planning to start a violent revolution in the event that Donald Trump wins. In our third segment today, we're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this important subject. I'm going to conclude today's program with a look at the unusual methods God can use to prepare someone for kingship. But to begin, we will start this program by looking at an especially dangerous trend. Several belligerent nations, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, making major advances in their nuclear weapons programs. Nuclear war isn't something most people give a lot of thought to, but biblical prophecy has a lot to say about why this is a threat we should take very seriously, as we will now hear in this report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques.
Some of the world's most belligerent and revisionist nations are making major advances in their nuclear weapons programs. And this is fueling a trend that the head of the United Nations says shows that mankind is living in the shadow of nuclear catastrophe. One location that has observers deeply concerned is North Korea. The situation in the North had been somewhat quiet since 2018, when the nation's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, began meeting with various heads of state, including United States President Donald Trump. Even though a deal to disarm the North had never been reached by those meetings, Kim was trying to show a measure of goodwill by refraining from testing nuclear weapons or long-range missiles, and even by refraining from showcasing the nation's long-range missiles. But on October 10th, that came to an abrupt end when North Korea held a parade commemorating the 75th anniversary of the establishment of the Workers' Party of Korea. And during that parade, the North unveiled a new missile whose size and apparent capability surprised even seasoned military experts. Melissa Hannum of the Open Nuclear Network commented on this new intercontinental ballistic weapon, saying, quote, "This missile is a monster," end quote. And the details show that she's exactly right about this. The missile was transported on an 11-axle military vehicle. And Michael Elliman, the head of nonproliferation and nuclear policy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, published estimates saying that this missile could deliver a nuclear payload of 2,000 to 3,500 kilograms to any point in the continental United States. So that makes this new missile even more capable than the Soviet Union's R-16 or R-26 intercontinental ballistic missiles. Experts believe the new weapon not only has twice the thrust of North Korea's previously tested Hwasong-15, but the new one is also designed to carry multiple massive warheads. So that means it can strike several targets simultaneously, which makes interception exponentially more difficult. This is an astoundingly powerful weapon, and the fact that the North showcased it after so many months of walking more quietly, could very likely be a sign that the country is returning once again to an international stance of aggression and belligerence. Not even a week before North Korea unveiled its new missile, the Russian Navy celebrated Vladimir Putin's 68th birthday by test-launching the new Zircon hypersonic cruise missile. The Zircon was fired by the North Sea Fleet frigate Admiral Gorshkov on October 8th, and it hit a maritime target some 280 miles away in the Barents Sea. This marked the first time it has been fired at an actual sea target. The TASS news agency reported that the weapon reached speeds of Mach 8. That's 9,000 feet per second, or 8 times the speed of sound. Back in 2019, Putin announced that the Zircon would have a range exceeding 600 miles, and he said that since the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with the U.S. had been dissolved, Russia was in the process of developing a portable, land-based version. But whether land or sea-based, the reason why the Zircon and other hypersonic weapons are so significant is because they are literally unstoppable, even by the U.S.'s most advanced defense technology. The National Interest explains, quote, "The impact of speed, extreme altitude changes, and maneuverability, especially during the final phase of flight, present both offensive opportunities and defensive obstacles. America can't stop them." End quote. Writing for The Diplomat earlier this month, East Asian security analyst Stephen Stashwick affirmed this assessment. He wrote, "If the Zircon works as advertised, it would present a significant potential threat against any other nation's surface fleet, because the speed of maneuverable hypersonic weapons is so great that they are considered to be effectively impossible for targeted vessels to defend against." And of course, these missiles that are literally unstoppable are designed to deliver nuclear warheads to their targets. This fact is overwhelming to contemplate, but it is reality. And meanwhile, Russia's also engineering nuclear-powered cruise missiles, nuclear-armed underwater drones, and other destabilizing weapons designed to rip through all American missile defenses. And on October 13th, Moscow rejected the U.S.'s proposal to extend the last remaining bilateral nuclear arms control agreement between the two nations. Surely this is a country that is preparing for nuclear war. Russia's landmark test came just weeks after China made a test launch of its famous DF-21D carrier killer ballistic missile at a target in the South China Sea. This two-stage solid-fuel rocket can launch a nuclear warhead of up to 500 kilotons at targets as far as 2,500 miles away. It is the first known anti-ship ballistic missile, or ASBM, that's able to hit moving aircraft carrier strike groups from land-based long-range launchers. China's launch of this astoundingly powerful weapon happened on August 27th. That's just one day after China had accused the U.S. of flying a U-2 spy plane through a no-fly zone near the Chinese coast. Clearly, this test was intended to show America that China has the ability to hit the U.S. with incredible firepower, and to possibly destroy the aircraft carriers that help give the U.S. Navy such an edge over all others. Harry Konzianis, a senior fellow for defense policy at the Center for the National Interest, is among those who received and understood China's message with this launch. He said the DF-21D's advanced capability means it will make the lives of American and allied military planners more complicated. Complicating matters further still, last month the Pentagon released its annual report to Congress about China's military power, and it said that China is in the process of doubling its nuclear arsenal. It's expected to soon have 400 thermonuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Germany started its annual Steadfast Noon nuclear combat exercise on October 13th, which includes training German military personnel to mobilize and drop the nuclear bombs that the U.S. has stocked in Germany. GermanForeignPolicy.com reported on the drills on October 14th, writing, "The objective is to train what is known as nuclear sharing. This provides for German pilots in German fighters, when necessary, to deliver and drop U.S. nuclear bombs on the targets. For this, there are around 20 U.S. nuclear bombs stocked at the Buchel Air Base in the hills of the Eifel. In the Steadfast Noon context, the Bundeswehr regularly exercises bringing these bombs from their underground storage to the fighters and mounting them for transport." End quote. In this year's iteration of Steadfast Noon, Belgian, Dutch, and Italian fighters are also taking part. GermanForeignPolicy.com called attention to this aspect of the drills, stating, "The international participation is of interest, inasmuch as, according to specialist circles, there are 20 U.S. nuclear bombs stocked not only in Buchel, Germany, but also stockpiled at air bases in Belgium, in the Netherlands, and in Italy." End quote. In 2014, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury discussed the dangers of America's nuclear sharing plan with Germany and other European nations. He wrote, "In Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, Germany, and Turkey, the United States has about 150 to 200 thermonuclear bombs. Nuclear weapons are a horrific menace. Just one can vaporize a city full of people. 200 of them are enough to destroy the whole world. Yet, America has given those bombs to these five nations, two of which were our bitter enemies just 70 years ago. The crucial question is, does the United States really have control over those bombs?" Mr. Fleury then continues, writing, quote, "How naive is America to entrust this immense firepower to nations that so recently, and throughout history, have proved to be the enemies of the free world? We want to trust Germany, but history screams that we shouldn't. The sobering reality is that any one of the countries that have those bombs could take control of these weapons by force and use them against the U.S. End quote. Finally, we come to a nation that can't be omitted from any discussion about the threat of nuclear war, and that is Iran. Iran is not yet a nuclear power, but it is the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, and it's on the fast track to joining the nuclear club. Back in June, the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, voiced serious concern over Iran's repeated violations of the terms of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the nuclear deal. And the IAEA commented on Iran's repeated refusal to cooperate with probes into its undeclared nuclear material. One part of the IAEA report from that month states, "The agency notes with serious concern that for over 4 months, Iran has denied access to the IAEA, to two locations, and for almost a year, Iran has not engaged in substantive discussions to clarify IAEA questions related to possible undeclared nuclear material and nuclear-related activities in Iran." Clearly, this terror-sponsoring nation is hiding everything it can about its development of nuclear bombs. And more experts say the world must take action before it's too late. David Albright, for example, the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, said the IAEA's June report was, quote, "telling the world that there is a huge problem here, and that it's time for the world to get involved." Albright continued, saying, "Iran has accumulated so much low-enriched uranium that it now has enough material to shorten the breakout times to develop a nuclear bomb quite dramatically. Such breakout times may now be as low as 3 months." End quote. Given these various nuclear developments from recent weeks and months, it should come as no surprise to hear that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned this month that the world is now living in the shadow of nuclear catastrophe. Guterres made the remarks at a summit commemorating the International Day for Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. And he said that though progress has been made toward ridding the world of nuclear bombs over the last few decades, this progress has now stalled and is at risk of backsliding. He said the regression is fueled not just by the technological advancements that we just took a survey of, but also by, quote, growing distrust and tension between the states that possess nuclear weapons. And it is true that nuclear China and nuclear India are presently at each other's throats over a border dispute. Nuclear Pakistan and India too. And then Taiwan, which is backed by the nuclear-armed United States, is teetering on the brink of open war with China. And of course, Russia is pushing against its enemies in multiple locations. And the list of potential flashpoints goes on and on. Truly, the distrust and tension between nuclear-armed nations are growing. The effort that Guterres spoke of to completely denuclearize the world is a noble goal. But the fact is that none of mankind's various disarmament efforts, or peace plans, or treaties have been able to secure sure and lasting peace. In all such ideas and efforts, there's nothing to forcibly prevent unfathomably destructive weapons from being used. And that means there's no true cause for hope. But there is hope in the Bible. In his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, Mr. Fleury writes, quote, "Only God can solve our number one problem, that of human survival." Mr. Fleury's booklet makes the Bible's plan for a certain and hope-filled solution clear. But he shows that the scriptures also contain some terrifying warnings, showing that the current tensions will continue to rise, and that in the near future, nuclear war will erupt. Matthew 24, verses 21 through 22, record Jesus Christ saying, quote, "For there will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it will never be so great again. In fact, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive." That's the New Living Translation, and it's easy to see that this time of calamity could only be describing a global nuclear war with enough detonations to cause nuclear winter. Only that kind of conflict could threaten to end every human life on the planet. Amos 5, verse 3 talks about this future war and reveals that in some cities only 10% of the population will live. Jeremiah 2, verse 15 shows that other cities will be entirely scorched by nuclear devastation, without a single person left. These are chilling prophecies, and they confirm that the world is living in the shadow of nuclear catastrophe. But the prophecies don't end with nuclear war destroying all human life. Continuing that passage in Matthew 24, just after Christ said that nuclear war at the end of this age would be so devastating that it could wipe out mankind, he then added an absolutely crucial detail. Regarding that nuclear war, he said, quote, "But it will be shortened." This is vital. It means nuclear World War III will be cut short. It means that before the world powers detonate enough nuclear and other weapons to entirely obliterate mankind, Jesus Christ will interrupt the mayhem. Mr. Fleury explains in his booklet, "The good news is God will shorten the time span and save us alive. But if he did not intervene, there wouldn't be anyone alive on this planet. He'll let it go a long way so that people learn they can't rule themselves. Men don't know the way of peace. God knows. And if you keep his law of love, it will bring great joy and peace into your life." Mr. Fleury goes on to explain that just after that time of unprecedentedly devastating war, Christ will usher in an age of unprecedentedly beautiful peace. Amos 9, verse 14 says that all those cities that will have been left with only 10% of their populations will be rebuilt. Jeremiah makes clear that as the people rebuild, each individual will come to know the true God, and they will rejoice in keeping his law. As a result, that great joy and peace that Mr. Fleury mentioned will permeate the world. Regarding this future time of worldwide peace, Isaiah 2 verse 4 says, "Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So it's clear that war, nuclear and otherwise, will become a memory, just a relic of a bygone era. One last quote from Mr. Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, says, "We are now at the edge of this nuclear abyss. As all these horrible signs come to pass, we know Christ is about to return."
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As America prepares for a presidential election in less than 2 weeks, both sides are digging in, and evidence is emerging that at least one side is preparing for violent revolution, as we'll now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
A member of the executive committee of the Colorado Democratic Party is planning a revolution in the United States if President Trump wins re-election. Investigators working for Project Veritas secretly recorded a series of interviews with Chris Jacks and published them on October 13th. The exposé is part of an ongoing video series exposing the communist infiltration of the Bernie Sanders movement and the Democratic Party. Yet here is one of the clips from Jacks' video exposé.
I want to make this point very loudly and very clearly. I said it nicely before, but I'll say it more curtly now. 2020 is a political revolution. I am going to do everything morally acceptable to win. I will lie, I will cheat, I will steal, because that's morally acceptable in this political environment.
If all this cheating does not stop President Trump from winning re-election, Jack spoke about the need for violence. Later in his interview, he says, "I'm going to be in my garage right next to my gun safe all night long on November 3rd, because that is how serious I take this stuff." Well, when it comes to civil war, violence type stuff, there's always the military guys, like the former guys that stand up for the right thing when the time comes, and we got to get some of those type of people involved. Jacks also noted that to change the country, it would be necessary to target billionaires for assassination. Here's clip three.
You really want to change this country that way with violence? There's only one way to do it. You got to get people that are close to billionaires and start just random billionaires start turning up dead. Populist uprisings have power because we used to kill people. We used to hang people from gas stations. We used to cut off their heads. So we don't have to actually cut heads. We just have to say that we're willing to cut heads.
After publishing this video expose, Project Veritas founder James O'Keefe confronted Jacks with the footage, and Jacks confirmed that he stood by everything he said in the interviews, even after they were made public. This is worrying, considering that Jacks works as a trainer, mentor, and on-the-ground quarterback at Our Revolution protest. It is even more concerning when you know that Jacks is not the first activist to espouse such bloody ideas. Last January, Project Veritas released video footage of two Bernie Sanders staffers predicting that America may be on the verge of a Bolshevik revolution.
Militant labor movement is kind of our last real kind of chance before, you know, we try other means. After we abolish landlords, we don't have to kill them, you know what I'm saying? that's my feeling. I think that's damaging to the soul, but there you go, Micah. there were plenty of excesses in 1917 that I would hope to avoid.
And shockingly, Bard was one of the more moderate people revealed by Project Veritas. Yet another Our Revolution activist, Kyle Jurek, even suggested the use of prison camps to re-educate Trump supporters.
There's a reason Joseph Stalin had gulags, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, gulags were a lot better than what the CIA has told us that they were. Like, people were actually paid a living wage in gulags. They had conjugal visits in gulags. Gulags were actually meant for re-education. Greatest way to break a billionaire of their privilege and their idea that they're superior, go out and break rocks for 12 hours a day. You're now a working class person, and you're going to learn what that means.
Jurek has also warned that cities would burn if President Trump were reelected. America has already witnessed a lot of burning this summer as Black Lives Matter-inspired riots over the death of George Floyd caused $2 billion in property damage across the nation. And a number of radical activists are threatening even more violence. The average American probably thinks an event as violent as the Bolshevik Revolution could never happen here in the United States. But he does not realize there is an organized movement working to abolish the U.S. Constitution and establish a communist system of government. With more than 100,000 members, our revolution acts as a front for the three most influential Marxist groups in America, the Democratic Socialist of America, the Communist Party USA, and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. And many our revolution activists are committed to making sure America's streets are filled with rioters. The late Herbert W. Armstrong explained in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the peoples who settled in the U.S. and Britain descended from the ancient Israelites. God made unconditional promises to Abraham to give his descendants great material wealth, and God gave the U.S. and Britain nearly three-fourths of the world's usable resources during the peak of their power. But God did not promise to keep blessing these nations if they rebelled and turned away from him. A prophecy in Leviticus 26 states that if the descendants of Israel came to despise God's statutes, he would strip away their blessings and allow their cities to be laid waste. In a January 1949 Plain Truth article entitled The Plain Truth About Communism, Mr. Armstrong specified that communism is a tool of the devil to blot out America's blessings. He wrote, "The real goal of communist plotters is the violent overthrow of the United States and the British Empire. Why? They are the real capitalist nations. We possess nearly three-fourths of the world's capital, its developed and usable resources and wealth. The plain truth, known by so few, is that we possess greater wealth and national resources than any other nation ever did because God Almighty gave us this wealth in fulfillment of the birthright promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And communism is the devil's effort, through his demon-inspired human tools, to take from us the greatest national and economic blessings God ever conferred on any people." Mr. Armstrong based his forecast of future events on trends on Bible prophecy. Hosea chapter 7, verses 8 and 9 predicts that the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel would mix themselves with foreigners and, by extension, their foreign ideologies. The far-left ideas put forward by the Democratic Party today are not based on traditional American culture, which is largely based on the Bible. They are ideas that were brought to America from German and Russian universities. For decades, these anti-Bible ideologies have subversively devoured America's strength, while the average citizen knows it not. Soon, the atheistic ideas of communist philosophy will ignite a violent revolution. In Isaiah 1, chapters 4 through 7, it reads, "O sinful nation, people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger, they are gone away backward. Why should you be stricken anymore? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint." Now this passage is describing cause and effect. The people are laden with iniquity or sin, therefore the whole head is sick, the government is corrupt, the nation is faint, and as a consequence, the people revolt more and more, and this revolution intensifies until strangers burn down America's cities and tear down America's system of government.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It is alarming how often you're getting these kinds of exposés coming out. It's clear that there are some activists out there who really do talk the language of explicit revolution. You wonder how widespread this kind of thinking is within the Democratic Party.
And probably quite a bit more widespread than most people would prefer to believe. I know the one of the clips we played today from the Kyle Jurek, they played that back in that came out in, back in January of this year, and I almost didn't write about it at the time because I thought, oh, well, it's just one crazy guy. But then no, this is the fifth clip that Project Veritas has exposed, and they've all been either members of the Sanders campaign, or like I said, members of the Democratic Party, people who are actually like receiving a salary, and especially some of the clips they released earlier in the year, the people were even saying that these ideas were more widespread in, like said, the Our Revolution movement than you'd think. I mean, Project Veritas has put a spotlight on five people, but they're saying that like a lot of their coworkers, like I said, right, they know their. Or I guess now that the Project Veritas exposés have come out, is like not like everyone in the nation knows some of these views. And like I said, I haven't heard of Bernie Sanders or the Democratic Party firing anyone today.
That's right. And you can't look at these as being independent of the fact that you actually have had prominent members, even members of Congress, who have come out openly advocating, if not they may be supporting, they say it's understandable that you're having the kind of violence in America's cities today, that they view it as a legitimate expression of dissent in America today.
Right.
So even though there are a few who are taking it to the extremes that this individual is, really, in a sense, it doesn't take too many people like this. If you have a mainstream organization that is essentially afraid to really put a stop to it, or they're tacitly supportive of it.
Yeah, afraid to put a stop to it, and then also supporting the larger protest movement, because most politicians, Democratic politicians, they might say that they think looting is understandable, but then they actively support the protest, and they always put the caveat on there that most of the protests have been peaceful. But like I said, it only takes a few people like this at a protest movement to turn it into a riot. There's actually one of the communist organizations I didn't mention in this data report is like the Revolutionary Communist Party USA, one of the most radical communist movements in America, that actually only has about 500 people. But there are 500 activists who, like almost every major Black Lives Matter protest, you'll see signs with RevCom.com in the lower corner where they're making the signs. And then they're also... the police have caught a couple individuals that go from protest to protest to protest to protest, and then like throw rocks at a police officer or something, right, like that, just to kind of like you get that ball rolling,
stir the pot,
get a police officer mad at you, and then he does something. And then, like I said, it was a quote unquote peaceful protest becomes very violent because of the agitating of people like this.
This man is talking about links to the French Revolution. He's talking about bringing out the guillotines and basically chopping off the heads of the 1%. And you look at history, and really, it shows you exactly what happens when you have movements like this. And to look at the French Revolution really is an instructive lesson in history. You compare what happened in France with what happened in the United States. And really, in the United States, there was a revolution, but the people who led that revolution were doing so very much in pursuit of religious freedom and wanting to worship God according to the dictates of their conscience, and were trying to establish a society that allowed for God to be very much a part of society. In the French Revolution, you had really similar ideals in a lot of ways, but without God in the picture. It was a very secular movement, and that proved to be very different, far bloodier, much more dangerous. And there's definitely nothing nothing pious about these individuals who are being exposed in these reports from Project Veritas. So there doesn't seem, this man has no moral scruples holding him back from doing whatever he wants to do. He talks about lying and cheating and stealing, and there are definitely people who are interested in using violence as a tool in their arsenal as well. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about evidence that continues to emerge that there are leftists planning violent revolution in the event of a Donald Trump win, or even if a Biden administration is insufficiently radically progressive. Andrew wrote an article about this, Democrat Plans Violent Revolution if President Trump Reelected. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we have students from around the world. We have two students from Zimbabwe, and they have done exceptionally well here at college, and it's gotten us talking about the education they received back home that prepared them to come here, what their perspective is on the education available here in America. They agreed to join me in the studio to talk about this. So we have Rufaro Manyepa. Why don't you say your name?
Rufaro Manyepa.
Okay, I was close. A junior here at the college. And you've heard Rufaro before on Trumpet Hour because we hired him onto the trumpet staff for his student work program, and he's doing a very good job for us. So hello, Rufaro. It's great to have you here. We also have Kumbirai Matemadombo. Can you say that?
Kumbirai Matemadombo.
Okay, I'm close. He's a sophomore here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, so it's good to have you as well, Kumbi. So tell me about the schooling that you both received in Zimbabwe. You represent the public and the private school system. Why don't we start with you, Rufaro, as far as public school?
Right. Well, the education system in Zimbabwe was patterned after how it is in England. And so we have primary school for the young lads from grades 1 to 7. And then for high school, it's forms 1 through to 6. And I went to public school primarily throughout that entire time. And the main difference there is between public school and private school is just the range of education that you get. Private schools tend to offer a more international type of accolades. For example, when you hear from Kumbi, he managed to take the SATs from his own school because they offered things like that, and they expand you more and open you up more to world opportunities. But as far as the actual education itself, it tends to be very, very similar. Private schools just have maybe fewer students sometimes than do public schools.
So tell me your perspective. You actually went to private school, Kumbi.
Right. From my very first day at school, I was in private school all the way till I finished high school. And yeah, like what Rufaro was saying, it's more geared towards building like an international kind of person, you know, someone who can go out into the world, travel. Like even at school, we have these student exchange programs where, for example, in my high school, for 2 years, one person from Zimbabwe would come to an American school and basically receive an American education, then come back home and share that education with us. And, you know, we had things like tours. We'd go to other countries. Some people went to France, some people to South Africa, some people to Germany. Mm-hmm. And this was for an extended period of time, just studying how other cultures work and things of that nature.
So I think you've both done very well here. I guess the question that I'm interested in is, were you sort of in the upper tier among students, or is, say, the education that you received and just how well educated you are pretty standard among Zimbabwean youths?
For me personally, I was far, far, far from the top echelons of the school system. Mm-hmm. We basically have a set system. So in like form one, they divide you because there's about 150 pupils in the form. They divide you by classes of 30. So there'll be the first set, the second set, the third set, and the fourth set, and then the fifth set. I was right at the bottom in the fourth set. But even still, like just the education you receive, it's stellar some of my classmates right now who are graduating with their master's degrees, they were the first set pupils, and they're doing amazing things like actuarial science, medicine, just these fantastic opportunities they've been given because they were at the top.
How about you, Rufaro?
I was pretty high up there as far as performance was concerned, but the difference wasn't massive. It wasn't a huge gulf, because the idea behind education is what really drives it. The culture, the way that education is viewed as a whole by Zimbabwe, is pretty much what drives it. Because when you look at the difference between Zimbabwe and America, for example, there's so many different things that Americans can do to be successful in life. You can be a singer, you can be a dancer, you can be a poet, you can be a writer, you can be an athlete. So many different avenues to success. But when you look at
Zimbabwe... Not too many successful poets.
that's fair. You look at Zimbabwe by comparison, and you don't have any wildly successful athletes, you know, millionaires like you have here. The singers back home average the same salary as a teacher, that sort of thing. Like, you don't have people who are very successful from following the arts or sports. Education is always impressed upon you as the one route to success. Mm-hmm. We don't have all the systems the different avenues for success that you have in the first world countries. And so parents are always stressing to children, you have to focus on education. You have to be a good student. You have to do well in school. And that's inherent in the culture that every student has as a general rule.
So, Rufaro, you've been here for a few years, Kumbi for a couple of years now, and you've probably gotten a sense... both from attending college here and just talking with your classmates and peers here about the education that they received. Right. What has struck you as being different about the education that you received? What subjects were emphasized? Mm. How they were taught that may surprise, say, American listeners?
Okay, for one, when I first came here, I was so shocked that people are more interested in like the art subjects. We call them the art subjects, like English literature, English language, and stuff like that. In Zimbabwe, once you pass a certain age, they want you to focus on specific subjects. So this is like when you're 16, you now focus on science and mathematics, so you focus on the arts, English literature, history, and subjects of that nature. And one thing I found was that even though people focus when they're 16, they still have a massive background training in all the subjects. They've basically been given a liberal arts education up till that point, and then they tell you to focus on one. And in America, it's very different because people don't focus on math that much. So, like, the math we do in science, I find it very rudimentary because it's really easy for me. I did this in the seventh grade. Mm. But some of my classmates are saying, yeah, wow, this is really hard mathematics. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess that's something. Mm. The physics we do back home, it's extremely difficult.
Is it mostly math and science that you find that disparity?
Well, it depends, like what Rufaro was saying, what your parents tell you. You know, if you want to be a doctor, you need to know maths, chemistry, science, and biology, basically. Yeah. And you focus on that. If you want to be a writer for a newspaper, you have to focus on what Rufaro focused on.
Yeah.
I would agree with that and say that in general, I think school back home is just harder. Yeah. It's incredibly difficult. I remember in high school, when I was 17, if I'd compare to like the midterms that we take here, the final exam or a midterm would have 5 questions. And they're all essays. Just as far as volume is concerned, you're expected to handwrite at least 5 pages for you to be able to qualify for the most, the maximum amount of points per question. Mm-hmm. So that's in a 2.5-hour exam, you're expected to write basically 20 pages. And that's just as far as content is concerned. That's just volume. As far as the actual content is concerned, it has to be up to scratch. You know, you can't just be waffling for 4 pages for you to get the full the full content, and you don't get any lead in, you don't get any, it's no multiple choice, it's just an essay, and you just get one question, a couple of sentences asking you to explain a certain idea. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what question is coming, you don't have a study guide, you basically just have an entire textbook, and they pick out one specific question from the textbook, and you have to answer that. You don't know what it is, you have no clue, it could be 20 questions that they ask. So you have to study everything, and then just write on one thing, and write a ton on that one thing. That's basically how it is across the board. It's just a lot more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So what was the culture like in terms of how much peer pressure there was to try to achieve? Because it in America, I think there's a very strong culture that is kind of anti-intellectual and anti-academic, where there's actually pressure to do poorly if you want to be seen as cool or to be popular among your friends.
Right. So on that point, I'll just bring up how this Zimbabwean education, as Rufar was saying, is based off what the British Empire was trying to build. You know, subjects for the British Empire need to be well-educated, need to be driven, need to basically want to be successful. And one thing you see with the Zimbabwean education is that's what happens through it. And, you know, they drill you in these various subjects so you have a general knowledge. Then they make you go to specific knowledge. And by the end of it, you come out and you're very able. You're very able to compete in the workplace, to get hired with your job. While juxtaposing that with the American education, you see that they just give you the information and say, do with it as you please. So there's not that same incentive to be the best you can be, to try and make it to the top set or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. It's so funny. We always used to watch American shows or movies, and you see the smart kids, you know, the ones on the debate team or the mathletes, you know, they're the nerds or something like that, and they're looked down upon. Back home, the smart people are the quote-unquote cool kids. You know, when you're intelligent, you usually have the group of intelligent people. They're the most influential people in the school. Everyone wants to be like them. Mm. And they're not just smart. You know, they're good in sports as well. You know, they're well-spoken. They're in the debate team, the quiz teams. And those are like the students that are looked up to in school. And so there is this positive peer pressure in which everyone there wants to be like that. And like he said, the British did really well in making sure that everyone has that sort of education. My dad and his grandfather were taught directly by Brits, you know, by actual Britons who got naturalized in Zimbabwe. And so it just created this culture that keeps going on and on, as opposed to how you do see it in America today, in which there's a great reluctance towards having an excellent education.
You know, you see interviews with school kids from a few generations ago in the 50s, and they're very articulate, they're well-spoken, they're well-educated. It seems like we really have lost something dramatic in the last few generations, where you've had this change in that academic culture. And it does infect a whole lot of young people. I think there's obviously kids that are going to better schools that where you don't have that sort of pressure to do poorly. Imperial Academy that we have, that's the sister school, the grade school of Herbert W. Armstrong College, is definitely one that I see my kids have that pressure to do well, you know, and it makes all the difference when you're moving in that direction. But you just have to wonder how much stature has America lost just in the last couple of generations because of exactly what we're talking about here.
Right.
So given what you have seen being in this country, or maybe even some of the media that you've seen, what has surprised you about America's education relative to what you experienced?
I watch sometimes some videos online, you know, when a guy goes up and asks some people some questions about American history, like when did America attain independence, etc., etc., and people won't know the answer. And you have even sometimes college professors who don't know the significance of 1776, for example. And that's the most shocking thing that teachers in America now, if they're not passionate about the facts, they're passionate about teaching just lies and fallacy. And that's the big difference with how it was back home. Pretty much all my teachers were so passionate about what they taught, and they taught the truth. They taught facts. You know, they weren't interested in peddling some sort of propaganda. And you'd imagine that maybe in Zimbabwe, you know, there would be an anti-colonial slant to the education. And they are Zimbabwean, so maybe there's a little bit of that comes in. But for the most part, we learned things that were true. We learned from textbooks that were written by Britons, and everyone is so passionate about giving us that education. And so we then learned that as well. But then today you have teachers who don't really care about teaching the truth, who don't care about teaching the right things. And that translates to what you have with the students that you have in the classrooms. And that is a really big difference between America and Zimbabwe.
Fascinating. Well, the teachers definitely make all the difference. Their passion and whether they're teaching the right things or not definitely impacts the effectiveness of that education. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It really is a pleasure having you here at the college, the perspective that you bring, and I'm very glad that all of the students here and even us faculty have the exposure to some of these perspectives that you bring on subjects like this. Really fascinating discussion. We've been talking with Rufaro Manyepa and Kumbarai Matemadombo, two Herbert W. Armstrong College students, telling us about their educational experience in their home country of Zimbabwe. Really appreciate your perspective and your time, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Some people dream of becoming royalty. A young girl wants to be a princess, or a child thinks of becoming a king or a queen. It's the stuff of fairy tales. But it's a lot more than that. If you look in the Bible, God actually says that He's making His people spiritual royalty. He calls the members of His church a royal priesthood. He says that they're kings and priests. Even their children are called princes in all the earth. He promises to give us a crown. He says we're going to sit on thrones, ruling under the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. Now, how does God train someone for royalty? You might think of formal dinners where you learn how to sip soup from the correct spoon and properly butter your dinner roll, or you learn how to wave properly, or how to enjoy classical music or fine art. All of these things have their place, but God's royal training isn't just a life of fancy dinners and opulent palace affairs. If you want proof, just look at King David. How did God prepare this man for kingship? Look at the history and you see just how difficult training for a godly royal position can be. David received his call to greatness as a youth. He was actually anointed king while he was still a teenager, even though he didn't actually assume royal authority until much later, 17 years later, in fact. You follow David's life from that point, and you see how God trained him. Under God's direction, David honed his talents. He progressed as a musician and a poet. He developed his work ethic and his skill as a shepherd. He grew in courage and wisdom. And above all, he prioritized building his relationship with God. These are all vital aspects of royal training. A major part of David's royal training, though, was something most people would not expect. God made David live as a fugitive and an outlaw for years. Israel's incumbent king, Saul, became jealous of David and tried to kill him. David had to flee for his life. You can read about this in Gerald Fleury's book, The Former Prophets, How to Become a King. He wrote, "It's interesting that a big part of David's training for his role as king was running from Saul." Now read Psalm 142 in the Bible, which David wrote while he was hiding from Saul's guards in a cave. He said, "My spirit was overwhelmed within me. In the way in which I walk, they have secretly set a snare for me. Refuge has failed me. No one cares for my soul. I'm brought very low." Clearly, David struggled to understand why this was happening as these anxious hours passed within that dark, inhospitable, rocky shelter. Surely he was thinking, wow, when I was anointed king, I never expected this. How could such an ordeal possibly be training for kingship? Mr. Fleury answers, spiritually, David was being fitted for his calling by learning how to depend on God constantly. He was sorely tested before he became king. God was preparing him to rule. Now, think of the challenges and the problems and the trials that you face in your life. Is God putting you through similar training? You may not face life-threatening situations, but difficulties, obstacles, occasional hardships, these befall all of us. And when those things arise, don't get frustrated or discouraged or bitter or angry about them. Recognize them as part of royal preparation. This Psalm 142 shows how David really was learning that invaluable lesson of how to depend on God. He wrote, "I cried unto the Eternal with my voice. I poured out my complaint before him. I showed before him my trouble." Now, that's a marvelous thing to do. If you feel overwhelmed, do what David did. Just pour it all out to God. Tell him everything. That is a very royal thing to do. Just imagine this young man hiding in a cave in the wilderness out of fear of being murdered by the king of the land. He's having to hunt for food every day just to survive. And what else was he doing with his time in those dangerous, trying, uncomfortable conditions? He was composing Psalm 142. He was writing poetry to God. That is the attitude of a godly royal. If you ever find yourself in that proverbial cave, some overwhelming challenge or trial, remember, this is royal training. You are following in the difficult footsteps of David on the path toward kingship. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Rufaro Manyepa, and Kumberai Matemadombo. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Oliver Wendell Holmes. Trouble creates a capacity to handle it. I don't embrace trouble, for that's as bad as treating it as an enemy. But I do say, meet it as a friend, for you'll see a lot of it and had better be on speaking terms with it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.